Welcome to Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. I thank you very much for joining us on the program every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time. We stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We are also archiving these programs at richarddugan.com, and we are rebroadcast Sundays at 2 p.m. Pacific time on a2zen.fm. So a lot of opportunity for you to tune into the program. We make our fourth annual visit to the hermitage, if you will, of Swami Vidyadhishananda, and it's a pleasure to be back in your presence and in your home again here in the Carpinteria area. And thank you again for allowing us to join you.
Thank you very much. It's fourth time in a row, and we couldn't do this on the Easter day, but we still did it in April.
Still in April, yes. Today's program, I would like to focus on Sanskrit. If we can do that, I've been doing a little bit of research. I cannot read it, but I've read a little bit of its origin, of some of the various religions or belief systems that use Sanskrit. And you have even talked in previous programs about the teaching of Sanskrit and its importance. And so for this program, I'd like to focus on that language and its importance to future generations who choose to learn it. It's not, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's not a language that we're all going to learn and all of a sudden we're all going to be speaking it conversationally. It's not meant for that, correct?
Many of our languages has evolved into somewhat easier languages than the structure and profound grammatical framework of Sanskrit over time. So we are speaking many languages which are similar sounding, but have become easier to use in our daily usage, mainly because Sanskrit is very structurally sound, and it doesn't allow us to kind of evolve a word the way we would like it. So many of the languages we are speaking are actually come from Sanskrit as a root, but has evolved to be a daily use language, a colloquial language. So we should not forget that Sanskrit is a root language, and its structure and the word factory, the way we make words, have a very close connection to natural sounds. Now, in many ways, English is very close in its sound structure and what the words sound like to Sanskrit. Many of the words are very, very close. We might want to relate English to Latinic and Greek roots, but actually they go further back and have roots in Sanskrit. And Latin is very, very similar to Sanskrit. For example, I'll give a very simple word which is still very popular. The word curriculum, yes, it sounds very, very similar to one of the very heavily used word in Sanskrit. And it comes from, if you look at the standard resources of etymology, then it'll say that it comes from the word curriculum, from Latin, curriculum. But actually that word is related to Sanskrit, gurukulam. So the word curriculum, which is structural study in class setup for like a coursework, actually is related to studying personally from the teacher in an honorable setup known as gurukulam, where guru is the acharya or the teacher. So the word gurukulam, curriculum, and curriculum is so very similar. The word we use, for example, in most popular use word in Sanskrit, which is in the world today, which is across the cultures, everybody understands the word soup, and it means what it is in Sanskrit. So we sometimes forget the root of the word, but soup or supena samsrushtam soupikam, soup is as is used in Sanskrit, even for the same meaning, and the meaning has not change much because there is no better word to say that. So point is we have come away to rapidly evolving languages, and whereas the structure has been held together in Sanskrit. So But for many other reasons, we should not search to find a conglomerate language. If we need to find a conglomerate language where, like every individual state in Europe, a country in Europe would like to communicate, then it would be better to go back to Sanskrit rather than try another language, because Sanskrit offers very attractive features of structure and grammar and depth, which will be... So there are other advantages which I can elaborate later based on your questions, but we can go back to Sanskrit, but we must remember that we have kind of come away from it.
Right. It's considered the oldest known language?
In many circles, especially in the where we practice it in India and in some parts of Europe, it is revered to be definitely one of the root languages, but if not the root language, but it's revered to be very, very ancient. And in terms of philosophy, in terms of ancient heritage, in terms of cultural heritage and antiquity, in terms of historical records and historicity of the ancient civilizations, it has really the maximum span and repertoire of literature still available. Yes, we have not used it in a way that modern science and many of the other branches in taught in universities have evolved. So we have not used Sanskrit, but that doesn't mean such literature does not exist at all. For example, there is very advanced mathematics and mathematical treatises in Sanskrit where the number system is very much there, and there are formulae and there are theorems and known as Ganit Shastra. And much of the astronomical calculations are captured in a piece of scripture. For lack of a better word, we can call it scripture, but actually it is more into mathematics and astronomy, known as Jyotisha, which is the science of light and heavenly bodies. Anything that is revealed can be mapped in terms of coordinates, and that uses very heavy mathematics. So anyone who is doing kind of predictive calculations of movement of heavenly bodies and calculating the upcoming eclipses, they use mathematical treatises written in Sanskrit. So we do have record of ancient civilizations, our parent civilizations and earlier civilizations can be grouped as Vedic antiquity, who are recorded to have used Sanskrit very heavily. But over the last 5,000 years, the use of Sanskrit has depleted steadily to the point that it is only in pockets, more alive in temple rituals and ceremonies known as Vedic fire ceremonies, and in texts which are memorized and recited and in chanting. But as far as daily usage, communication in common usage, as a spoken language, it's in pockets.
What I know of the Hebrew language, the 22 characters that comprise the alphabet, each character has what I refer to as it's a legend. It has its numerical ranking, if you will. It has a vibrational tone. It has a color representation. It has a history behind it, each character. Then you put those letters together and make words. You make something brand new, words into sentences into paragraphs, and so forth. Does Sanskrit contain that same kind of legend per character and so on and so forth, that when we translate from Sanskrit into any other language, we lose a great deal in that translation?
Yeah, many of the ancient languages are actually of the same likes and the same kind. And Sanskrit, of course, Varna and Matruka, and they have numerological assignments. And many of the texts you can read, compositions you can read actually diagonally backwards, they are tied together because these are written down as partitions of sound. So they have form and color, and they have and their intonations are imparted based on how they are grouped and structured. So exact same ethos is very much in Sanskrit. In fact, many of the mantra recitations are based on understanding of the relationship of color and form and the intonations of sound. So, and actually, chatushashti varnaha, so meaning 64 sounds, but 52 are in regular usage. So, and that's why the transliteration comes in, because 52 is condensed into 26 in English language. So we use transliteration or marks above and below on the letters to show the correct pronunciation. So it's tightly woven, just like what you just now mentioned about Hebrew.
And how many characters in the Sanskrit alphabet?
That's 52 in regular use.
It is 52, okay.
Right. 52 in regular use, but 64 total.
64, okay.
12 are less in use because they are variations of sounds in a way.
So, since I only have the knowledge of the English language to compare, which I have a feeling is not a great comparison, because I've heard it said that English is the hardest language to learn because it has 65 different tenses. And I don't want to get into a great deal of dissection in that respect, but Sanskrit, is it a difficult language from your perspective and from having taught it? And my understanding is there is a school in the UK that teaches the students Sanskrit.
Right. There are schools, and there is a school in UK which teaches the children, but Sanskrit is best taught early on.
Mm-hmm.
And if a continuous teaching is done for about 12 years, it is very good. One can get a very good grasp in spoken language, as well as it's not necessary that it needs to be taught directly with the grammar, but a simultaneous understanding of the grammar and the structure, how the word factory works using sound roots of sound known as dhatu, then it's very, very helpful to the beginner. But it's never too late. I have known connoisseurs and those who are interested in Sanskrit from varieties of perspectives to even learn it in their late 70s after retirement, and actually spend about a decade to learn it and appreciate it and read it and translate on their own and get a sense. Now, we get trained in a different way. We get trained to think in Sanskrit. So it's the sound structure. So when we relate to the sound through the oral tradition, we are forced to think using those sound structures. So we kind of live the language. And that allows us to kind of formulate our ideas. It's a very compact language and it's phonetic. So in a sense, for someone like me or my background, forget about the monastic background. If you just take the Sanskrit training, the languages which are difficult are those which are not phonetic. And those which use preposition. Now in Sanskrit, there is a matrix. So wherever you put in the matrix, the word itself is very complete. I'll give a sense. If you say, what is your name? But if you tell somebody without the proper subject-object relationship, what name is your? It's going to sound very strange. But in Sanskrit, tava nama kim is three words. You can now place it any way you like, because these are complete words from the matrix which does not change the meaning of the sentence. Kim tava nama, tava nama kim, nama tava kim, nama kim tava. You can do any juxtaposition of these three words, the meaning doesn't change, because from the matrix you are lifting the way the sound is coming at the end of the word defines what is its unique role in the sentence. So it's a very compact language. And to appreciate these nuances, one has to study in a structured manner, like a gurukulam or a curriculum that I talked about. And then you appreciate that why it is mostly passive voice, because we say Sanskrit means that it is that which is already perfected. In other words, it's given to us from a higher source. There's an appreciation for it. So you use passive voice. You don't say, I did it, I composed it. You tend to use a very humble passive voice and do not use preposition because it doesn't need. So for somebody who is trained in Sanskrit, when they come into definitely sweet language, definitely useful language, definitely scientific language, but if they come into a language which is not very phonetic and use a lot of prepositions and uses different tenses in different times, like just like you pointed out, it's going to make it difficult. The way, for example, someone like me, I relate to languages like that is I focus on the sound structure and I catch the sound and I think like that. I still think and compose in Sanskrit and then I try to put my prepositions and put the subject-object relationship and the verb and the tense and all that. So it still helps to know a very structured language as your preliminary language. So the foundations become very strong, and sometimes when I have traveled in Europe, I've just listened to the sound and I can catch what they're talking about, even though I don't know anything about their languages, right? And if the languages are spoken very fast without gaps between words, it becomes very difficult to catch, right? So, but the way we relate to languages is still to the sound structure, and without relating to the prepositions and the order of the words.
I've often looked at the various languages on the planet, including English. It's a code. And some people say, I can't learn another language. So then I ask those who were around during the, say, the advent of the computer and the early program codes. I guess there's COBOL. And then, of course, we came along with DOS, disk operating system, which I learned. And I remember typing my very first line of code on the screen and was amazed on two fronts that, my gosh, I wrote that, and I understand what I wrote, but it is a new language. So for someone to say, oh, I can't learn a new language, that is not true. But as you're speaking, I feel as though I'm back in English class once again, you know, and trying to take this in and understand it. And it's amazing that I've understood as much as I have from my English classes in today's life when I start listening to people speak, hearing television programs, commercials, speeches by various people, and the ways in which they phrase things sometimes doesn't make sense to my learning. And here you're telling me that no matter how you were to put those three words in whatever order, it's still going to mean exactly the same thing. I learned that in some form of Russian, they only have one word for, if you said lawnmower, or washing machine, or a car, they only have one word for machine, which would apply to all three of those. That doesn't seem to be true with Sanskrit?
It's good that you bring up Russian, because Russian sound and Russian languages, other than German, the closest language to Sanskrit still.
Oh, is it?
Yes. Yes, Sanskrit has many words which have contextual use. That doesn't mean you cannot qualify it. There are, of course, adjectives. And there is a fantastic aspect of Sanskrit known as samasa. You can conjugate the words. Yes? So, for example, there is an upcoming musical event that's happening. The main music instrument is veena. Now, but we want to say that it is a very beautiful, sweet, flowing musical rendition using that instrument. So there are two distinct words. We use the word madhuri, meaning a flow which is sweet and nectarine. Yes? So you can now conjugate the two words depending on what kind of conjugation rules, known as samasa, and that becomes veena madhuri. Now it's a single word. Okay, so therefore, contextual use can be done by combining words according to the rules of conjugation. Now, so machine, what kind of machine, you can really specify in Sanskrit. Absolutely, there is no problem. But there are words which mean general things. But to make it specific, you can give it that kind of conjugation and give it a spin. and it will exactly mean what it is. For example, dadhi is curd. Now, and then, so if you want to imply that you have mixed curd with rice, you will say dadhna samsrustam dadhikam. Now, dadhikam is curd rice. You do not have to say, oh, I want to mix rice and curd and I want to eat them together and create a long sentence construction. You can say dadhikam, that means curd rice. You have mixed yogurt and rice. So, same way, sopikam, supena samsrustam sopikam. Sopikam means soup and lentil soup and rice. So you can make these conjugations known as samasa, very powerful feature of the language. And we see that in English too. There are some remnants of the conjugation and similar sounds. But splitting it and expressing it gives another dimension. So our languages have evolved, that's fine. But Sanskrit, you do not have to restrict yourself to knowing one word. As long as you know how to use the words in the word factory, you have beautiful poetic expressions.
You said that there are pockets around the planet of people who are learning it, using it on a regular basis. Is that right?
Yes, there are villages in India who have absolutely, who are committed to keeping the spoken language. And there are mathematicians, few of them, who still would like to keep Sanskrit alive using some aspects of Sanskrit, Ganesh Shastra. There are Jyotisha experts who are basically astronomers, and they know, they use Sanskrit. And those who are chanters and those who are doing ceremonies, they may not know the language aspect as in spoken Sanskrit, but they know the text of Sanskrit well enough to have it learned by heart. And when they have memorized it by heart, they regurgitate during the ceremony the specific particular chanting sections. And this is the way it is alive in various pockets. And there are a few other ways, but there are a few villages and schools where only Sanskrit. You can only speak in Sanskrit, and no matter how much your struggle is, you cannot ask the teacher anything in any other language, which both of you might know, but they would like you to speak in Sanskrit. There are some pockets like that in India. And as far as grammar is concerned, and etymology, grammar, and resources of Ayurveda, for example, I know sections of Italy are very interested in Ayurveda. They have taken a lot of Ayurvedic literature. Russia, Germany has grammarians who are almost as good as those in India. There's a lot of repository of Sanskrit texts in England, understandably so because of the relationship with India over the past years. And so there are a lot of texts floating around. There are a lot of closeness of previous cultures. For example, the Baltic states, Sanskrit used to be very popular. Even now, it is oftentimes the chosen language as a second language, for example, in Lithuania. So there is a lot of heritage in Baltic states, the pockets, who are very much in love with Sanskrit and its virtues. But as far as using it in business, economics, you know, and like all the subjects you study in the university, we haven't cultivated it. And there are economic treatises, but we haven't cultivated it. So it will be very difficult to get in touch with the modern challenges using Sanskrit. You can frame it, but you may not be able to relate to it as an evolving culture. So we have gotten away from Sanskrit in those respects. But there are pockets in Asia, in Europe, especially these two. And of course, it's spoken in, you know, there are about 150, maybe a few more. Reasonably serious attempts and curricula in United States, and there are about 600 or so curricula and programs in the country. This number may have been updated. I did a little bit of research a few years ago, and that's how many 600 odd programs in United States who are interested in the cultural aspects and the heritage of Sanskrit. 150 of those more closely connected with Sanskrit teaching or dealing with literature.
I want to talk about the reason why you are teaching Sanskrit to children and adults for that matter as we continue. And you may wonder, why are you talking about this? And the reason is because, like classical music has been studied as its effect on the human body, the human mind, the human soul, my understanding, Swami Vidyadishanatha, Sanskrit has a similar, if not greater, impact or effect on the human being on all of these different levels. Is that correct?
Yes, that's one of the fundamental reasons that Sanskrit is being embraced by the ancient traditions, both the monastic traditions and the traditions of meditators. Part of the reason why Sanskrit is so precious is because, not because it is the repository of indigenous knowledge, but because it is connected to the natural sounds which are used very much in the limits of conception, powers of conception and perception used in meditation techniques. And so, yes, there is quite a number of study on impact of chanting, single sound, dual sound, intonated sound, how it affects vibrationally, energy-wise, our ability to relate to it. But one of the most interesting collection of studies in India, which I am aware of, and I was also working with those teams, had to do with memory and ability of the right brain, lateral thinking, and lateral abilities, and what is known as whole brain learning. Yes? So in many of the traditional Vedic schools, they were introducing the concept of Sanskrit as the medium of instruction and medium of learning and recitation, is because they wanted to see how the child develops in terms of whole brain learning. Can they grasp in a different way? Can they memorize faster? Do they have effects of the sound being chanted and recited in so-called impurer form and or unevolved form or something closer to the natural sounds? And there seems to be a very great connection, even though I would not know of any systematic study in a Western scientific paradigm that I can put my finger on. But I know that such studies have been done, and I know that in the traditional Vedic schools where they force you to study through the traditional methods, I would not call it directly the oral tradition. They do have different ways of using, but the purpose is whole brain learning. Do we use the left brain or the linear methods, or do we use first the lateral thinking abilities and conceptualization and memory? Does memory improve learning it by heart? Does it become easier during the learning process using Sanskrit as a tool, where you use the orally, the sounds and intonated sounds? And there seems to be a very heavy leaning and inclination and reliance on that method of learning as being superior method, because somewhere there is additional data in these schools that seem to indicate that the children actually become more emotionally mature at an early age when they get this kind of whole brain learning. So there is definitely a deep interest in sticking to that tradition. So many of the schools you go to, whether they're training for monks to become monks in the future, or they're training to become, let's say, conducting ceremonies as priests, or they are interested in chanting and somewhat you know, literature aspect of their language, they seem to prefer the traditional method of oral tradition and chanting and recitation and speaking in Sanskrit, precisely for the reason that you just asked about. In terms of meditation, we like to think in the Sanskrit, and we like to recite the specific sutra, which is kind of a text on the meditation technique in Sanskrit, and we like to ruminate and vibrate the sound in our mind after we have recited it, to the extent that we want to feel the energy of that sutra, that verse, Sanskrit verse, mentally, without actually even opening the mouth, and sort of have it revealed in the heart through our meditation. So there is a deep connection from the verses of meditation known as a sutra, and having it reverberate and reveal the inner meaning in the heart. And so that's our way of relating to Sanskrit in the monastic tradition, is not just Sanskrit as a language for speaking or using it or being in awe of its grammar, which is so structured, or creating new words and writing poetry. No, it's more from the purpose of using the tenets and the verses of meditation, the promise of realization in solitude, in a hermitage or in a cave, in the training during in the Himalayan mountains, and actually meditate on the verse by ruminating the sound in the heart, so to say. And then you keep on ruminating and reflecting, and until the meanings are revealed to you in a deep metaphorical way. And so this is the draw. Many of the monks have left everything to go into a very austere setup so that they can ruminate on these sound structures in silence, in external silence. Of course, internally they are reflecting on these verses. So you are absolutely right. These are the other aspects of Sanskrit which are very, very attractive.
It brings to mind, Sanskrit is teaching people to function on a three-dimensional paradigm in a three-dimensional world, whereas the other languages and even teaching processes are teaching people how to function in a two-dimensional paradigm in a three-dimensional world. So they're missing out. I've watched science fiction programs, and I watch the dilemmas that some of the characters get into when they're flying through space and they're chasing one another. And I'm thinking, yeah, you can go forward, backward, and left and right, but did you know you can go up and down too? You never see that. So it's like we're missing a part of the whole equation in that regard. In terms of the intonation or the tones, and you speak of it internally, for myself, not with any language, but just with tones, I know that as a child growing up, whenever I was ill, and I still remember this experience with my mother and one of my sisters, I was laying there, I think it was with the flu or something, and I was laying there, I was moaning. And I just would keep moaning. And my sister said to my mother, "Make him stop, he sounds terrible." She says, "No, that's how he heals himself." All I knew was it felt good. There was something about that tone that vibrated through my body. And I have been fortunate that I have not had to do that in the last 5 or 10 years, because I haven't really been that sick or ill. But I know, and I even encourage other people, if you're not feeling good, then find a quiet place away from people, because they're going to think you're a little odd. Go ahead and moan, and whatever tones come out, they will help you. When we speak these languages, the specifically Sanskrit, that's not so much in terms of healing qualities, but in terms of that whole lateral versus linear thinking and so forth. Is it also sort of, is there evidence to show, again, that they're sort of creating new synapses, new pathways in the brain? You mentioned memory. And also an emotional maturity earlier in life. That's what you're talking about, is it's not just the writing it and the learning it and understanding what the characters are and the words mean and so forth, but it's also speaking it, but also saying it internally and hearing the intonation that is having that impact.
Absolutely. Intonated recitation is very much the focus for its multidimensional use. And the children love it, and because they find new meaning to articulation using the sound. And so, and it, you know, everybody can appreciate that sound when it is recited or chanted or sung properly is very healing. So music is very healing too. But vocal ranges are explored in this intonated chanting. And they definitely are a big draw, because a lot of young students who are very bright, they choose the traditional method of learning mainly because of this intonated recitations, intonated chanting. And the what is definitely apparent is that they can memorize these lengthy literature of verse after verse after verse precisely because they are learning it through the intonated method. So definitely the intonations accentuates the memory and allows a holistic growth in the personality development. And if it didn't heal, it wouldn't do it.
Right. And I think that one of the things that is so striking to me is when I am listening to, say, a meditation, and somebody is chanting, and specifically the chants and so forth. And in most of the religious traditions that have been around for several hundred or thousand years, they have some form of that. I know that being born and raised Catholic in the Western Rite, but also exposed to and experienced the Eastern Rite of the Catholic Church, the cantors, and their singing in the back of the church and how it resonates through the church, that sound is also helpful, again, for the people who are may or may not be joining the cantor in singing or joining the chant or the mantra. And that's something else, too. There are people who seek out mantras from holy men, sages, what have you. Is that something that when you, if I don't know if you give people mantras or not, but if you were to do so, would it be in Sanskrit? And because I'm also thinking in terms of like there's Hindi, correct?
Yes, the prayer can be in any language because it's a language of the heart and it's connected with the depth of the seeking and being. But there are Sanskrit mantra which have kind of which are compact and like a sutra and they have a lot of power in them. You have to unravel it, and usually it is the number of recitation and how you recite that carries the power. That so when you have done the number of recitations in a particular way through discipline, it bears fruit. There is a result, and you can feel it, and it it is very palpable. It is tangible that the result of the mantra has fructified. And of course, the purpose of the very structured methods of intonated chanting is to create that ambience that you talked about in a church choir or in a cantor, and that's still very much the alive tradition in India, especially even in monastic training, even in monasteries. We chant, for example, the Om, the primordial sound, in different ways, and with the breath, between the breath, with the pauses, with the whole what we call vinyasa. A regimented flow that is evolving with the chant. And then there are specific chanters who create that ambience using the chanting process. And it is for all the uses that you have mentioned. And so chanting, singing, using verses, which are basically collection of mantra or sutra, which are very compact mantra, which are very compact verses, is very much the alive part of Sanskrit tradition.
Going back to a little bit of the basics of Sanskrit, what do we know about its origin? If it's the oldest known language, is there any way for us to know where it came from?
It was spoken by a group and the people who were known as the dwellers on the banks of River Saraswati. Now, River Saraswati already started eloping during the great Mahabharata war, which happened in, if you extrapolate the current calendar, 31-39 BC, if you look at the nuances of the calendar, it will come out to be roughly November of 31-39 BC. Well, they didn't have the same calendar at that time. But already at that time, Saraswati River was drying up in various places, mainly because of tectonic shifts and the glacier body that was feeding it from Himalaya and collecting all the headwaters, and the headstreams actually started shifting and drifting. So the headstreams died, and there are some remnant headstreams which are actually going the other way now. So there was a time when Rig Veda was chanted and then later on composed on the river bank of River Saraswati, and they were heavy users of a very special kind of Sanskrit known as Vedic Sanskrit. And they seem to be in the region of 3000 BC backwards for several thousand years. There seems to be ample data of that such a civilization existed, and they migrated to different regions, including Persia and in the Bactrian area and things like that. So Vedic Sanskrit has its own grammar, but that is attributed to River Saraswati. There is another kind of Sanskrit, which is classical Sanskrit, which is what is mainly spoken and used now, even though the Vedic Sanskrit or captured in Veda is still alive. But classical Sanskrit is attributed to River Ganga, which is still alive, and the grammar that is used in classical Sanskrit cannot completely explain the Vedic Sanskrit. So we have two brands of Sanskrit. One is more popular, known as classical Sanskrit, attributed to the indigenous knowledge stream or connected with River Ganga. And the other brand of Sanskrit, originally developed by the people who lived around the banks of the River Saraswati, is known as the Vedic Sanskrit, which is an older brand of Sanskrit. So we definitely have a historicity of, let's say, 6 to 7,000 years of Sanskrit. Now, why Himalayan valleys? Because it protected weather-wise, and it defied other geographical features. It had the glacier body, it had the rivers, it had the greenery all next to each other. Himalayan valleys have to be seen before one can believe how meadows can be at 12,000 feet. Even at 12,000 feet, there are tigers and leopards. So there is a whole new paradigm of why Sanskrit would have been thriving through the resonance of the mountains. And so it has survived, and our tradition itself, from meditation point of view and literature point of view, has been ascribed to the Himalayan mountains as where we have been able to preserve them. So I would say preservation of Sanskrit is definitely over 7,000. I would be not surprised if it's even longer. We don't have actual tangible evidence, but there is enough ample evidence from various models, archaeological model, anthropological model, linguistic model, that it is definitely probably over 7,000 years the Sanskrit language has been thriving. It's one of the root languages. It's an accepted root language, and whether it is the absolute global language, we cannot claim it, and it would not be correct to say that, you know, that nothing else was outside of Sanskrit. But we know of the people who spoke Sanskrit, and we know of the people who used Sanskrit in daily life. It was a very powerful civilization, which seems to have impacted the lores and stories and the languages of Europe. And similar ethos is prevailing about Southeast Asia and other parts of the world who have resonated very well with the sound structure of Sanskrit. So definitely it's a very ancient language, very, very ancient language. So we do have two traditions still alive, but Vedic Sanskrit is less used because it's a difficult grammar and it requires an additional bit. But classical Sanskrit is the popular brand of Sanskrit, which is still alive in various parts of the world. And the grammar is somewhat easier, and one doesn't have the words to analyze as in Vedic Sanskrit. So when we talk about the Veda and the four branches or the main 100,000 verses, that is actually Vedic Sanskrit, written, composed, orated, chanted, practiced on the banks of River Saraswati. Now, but when we talk about spiritual philosophy of a more modern perspective, like Bhagavad Gita, which is very popular, it translated into many languages, spiritual philosophy of the later kind, they are done in classical Sanskrit. Easier grammar, easier to recite, easier to sing, not so structured and in terms of its intonated structure and recitation rules as in the Vedic Sanskrit. So these two traditions, we can only say antiquity. We cannot put really a figure that we will all be agreeing with, because, you know, depends on what model you use, depends on your research, depends on whether we have really the knowledge of the ancient world. So what we can say is antiquity.
As we have been talking here about the Sanskrit language and its importance, and we've gotten into a great deal of detail. I feel as though I've also been to school today on the program, learning more about this. As we mentioned, you have a school in the UK, in England.
No, I don't have it, but I know of
it. You know of it, okay.
We run traditional Sanskrit schools in India inside the monasteries. Okay. And that has a very specific purpose of possibly getting few who would choose the monastic life also. But those are not out in the open. They are run inside the monasteries. And so I do oversee many of those curricula.
So then let me ask you, we've talked about the importance on the individual and the effects of Sanskrit on the individual. What is the effect on our society as a whole by these people learning Sanskrit? Because you mentioned about people going into the monastic life as well. And I've heard it said that if all of those of the various religions around the world stopped their praying, their meditating, the world would come apart at the seams. It's as if those in the monastic life are the glue that's sort of holding civilization somewhat together.
Very well put. Yes, absolutely. But it is not just the... our schools have that opportunity for the students to choose the monastic life because they're being taught in a monastic setup. But that's not the main goal. The main goal is still to make them noble individuals so that they can add to the collective. And Sanskrit has very powerful impact because it's a very compassionate language. It doesn't have any rude words. You can almost not say anything foul in Sanskrit. And the built-in structure seems to be all passive and forgiveness and compassion. So the idea of early emotional maturity, depth, sparkle in the eyes is all to create a holistic individual who do not buckle under pressure, can lead the life with its practical challenges being faced in the right steps and the right perspective. So it develops a very deep perspective. That's the whole idea. And then there is the collective aspect. We do group chanting. Teach group chanting. We do how to spread the vibrations of peace. There's a whole section of Sanskrit on peace chants. So the peace chants are orated not for their individual goal. In fact, there is no peace chant which said, do this for me, I want this. Peace chants by nature are for the collective. And it says, let us, let our minds, always there's our and us, and let there be peace, bliss, and happiness to all. And so the built-in nobility of the peace chants have to do with the collective. There is no individualistic goal in the peace chant. And that's a very heavy factor in the study process. So though the goal is that those, we cannot bring everybody. So those who are interested and those students who are interested by and will take up the challenge of the process, and it's hard work, 12 years of hard work to do the basic, And, you know, if one wants to do very high level of grammar, that's another extra study. But just like there is, you know, graduation, same way, there is equivalent of BA degree, there is equivalent of MA degree, there is equivalent of PhD degree in Sanskrit study. And it embraces a lot of those things. But what has happened is because we have monetized certain aspects of our livelihood, many of these Sanskrit adepts do not have proper livelihood. And there is this constant struggle in that section of the society who are sort of adept in Sanskrit, both from conducting ceremonies or from pedagogical point of view. They are, their repertoire of language is excellent, but they don't have a stream of livelihood which is parallel and sufficient and comparable to a modern curricula. And so therefore, from a monetary point of view, many of these families, many of these parents whose children are probably very interested but do not want to send them to a traditional school because, yes, they see the benefits in the individual, but ultimate worry is, you know, the survival and having enough. And so there's this dilemma in the parents. And a child cannot decide, so the parents have to agree. So we have this challenge of, you know, finding a placement for this bachelor, master's, and PhD. So that's why we provide an atmosphere where they can choose to lead a life where they can be Sanskrit adepts. They may not have monetarily a lot of wealth, but they have other kinds of wealth, and we want to show what kind of wealth. Because we cannot tinker the system to create monetizing avenues, monetary avenues for all the students who are studying in Sanskrit school, because ourselves being monks, we do not go and kind of create any avenues. We are not in a position to do that. So the students will have to grow, and ultimately, so many of the students choose parallel curricula and oftentimes go into universities to study other things so that they can get a livelihood which is more acceptable to their families and for the future generation. So there is this dichotomy, definitely.
Well, I've heard the phrase a few times when someone is asked, so you're going to college, what are you majoring in? Ancient Sanskrit? Oh, there's a lot of money in that. And these are some of the concepts that we're dealing with on some of our programs, in that you follow your passion. They say, this is what many people are saying, that you follow your passion and the money will follow. You know, it will come. It will come. And it never comes, or it doesn't seem to come for the majority of people who do just that. They do something with their lives that has meaning. And certainly what you're talking about has unfathomable meaning and impact on an individual's life. To that end, where would someone go in the United States in particular if they really wanted to learn ancient Sanskrit, wanted to have those kinds of benefits that you've talked about on this program today?
We won't be able to create the same ambience very easily. There are schools, we have structured curricula in the United States, as I said, about 150 quite serious ones. But to provide a kind of a cushion which is available in certain pockets, let's say in India, which I'm familiar with, and I'm sure similar places are available in other parts of the world, but in India, to recreate that kind of a setup where you can kind of live the dream of Sanskrit, and it will be very difficult. So I would say that pedagogical and regular learning of the language is still available, but a complete supporting setup where you get every student doing their math in Sanskrit and speaking in Sanskrit and singing in Sanskrit, that would be very difficult. That's even dying in India. It's a very hard challenge to keep that alive, to see what is the impact on the individual and the group. Even that in India is hard because of the same, the monetary concerns, and this society has not put enough energy to value it as a treasure, because everybody is, of course, kind of trying to do their best, but we only have very few schools left in India, which is kind of the dream atmosphere, where, you know, the child grows as a holistic individual with lateral thinking and has the deepest emotional maturity due to Sanskrit. And that experiment is fairly becoming difficult even in India. But there are very good new efforts, and there are certainly efforts going on in Europe, certain pockets. And we can keep talking about the great goals of Sanskrit and what an international heritage it is. But ultimately, putting together a paradigm where this is spontaneously feasible is itself a challenge.
So if somebody was just passionate about it, then where would they start? If there isn't a place, say in the States, and they were just committed to learning and assimilating this language into their lives, and they were willing to go to the ends of the earth to do so, would they be able to contact the Self-Inquiry Life Fellowship guidance to where to go next?
Yeah, we can certainly provide various resources inside the United States, and there are a lot of homeschooling avenues, and there are certain cities where communities have cultivated the right kind of teachers, and they have come over, and there is quite a bit of academic freedom in that sense to choose one's curricula too, but to have an ambience where you can really go deeply into the musicology, to math, and all those, there are such a kind of profound setup that will be very difficult to create in the same level as it is available in certain pockets of India. There are exchanges going on, and there are teachers who come in, they are visiting professors, there are school teachers, and I've had a lot of requests. We place them, we connect them, we give the resources, but I haven't found any similar setup as is in there in cases where I oversee the curricula in India, where both Sanskrit and the Vedic chanting, Sanskrit chanting is taught, and similar setup in mass with so many different teachers doing the different aspect of the language, that is going to be very difficult because the demand at that level is not there. You have to create a demand to have so many students wanting that.
Then if people want to do it and they want to get together and say, hey, this is what we want to do, I would say contact the Self-Inquiry Life Fellowship and see what happens from there. I mean, you know, stranger things have happened and greater things have happened. So never underestimate the power of dreams and passion and desire. Swami Vididhishananda, I want to thank you so much for sharing with us about Sanskrit today. I've received quite an education in just this short hour. And again, I thank you so much for allowing us to come into your home.
And thank you very much for hosting me 4 years in a row. And I'm sure if I'm here, I'll continue to be available for your radio interview. And I appreciate all the listeners who are valuing this perspective.
I look forward to coming back in another year. And I hope it's another 4 years that we're able to continue doing this. I look forward to that. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And we look forward to talking with you again next Saturday at the same time. And until then, love to Lal.